Well, one of the first things I wanted to show you is one of my favorite wild food plants, and that's grand fir needles. So every year you get new growth coming on the ends of the leaves, and just starting to go. It's usually a lighter green color. Grand fir is very flat needles, very aromatic. And I'm going to take a little bit of the grand fir needle and crush it and just let you smell it.
Oh, yeah, it's very lemony.
Lemony, a little bit of grapefruit, lots of citrus kind of components to it. So we use this aromatic quality in lots of things. And it's great just on its own as a tea. But we also use it to infuse honey. And we've infused sea salt. We make grand fir salt. We blend it with olive oil and make infused oils, which we, once you put a little bit of that on a dish, it's very, very, very aromatic, and you know, it's really amazing.
Mm. And one of the easiest things to find, probably, that you don't have to worry about, it's not going to poison you or anything.
No. Yeah, I mean, all of the firs, even spruce, pine, all those needles are not necessarily edible, but they're high in vitamin C, and they add great flavors to things you put it into. Like tea is a very common way to use a lot of these needles.
I can still smell that.
Yes. It kind of smells like Christmas. Yeah. But I think that it really, what was surprising to me was the citric elements. Particularly, I get a lot of grapefruit when I smell the grand fir. And Douglas fir is a slightly different aroma profile. This is a Douglas fir here. And the other thing about pruning these trees is it doesn't harm them at all. It's really just you're kind of pruning and you're making the growth a little denser. So it's a renewable harvest. And there's the Douglas fir.
Yeah. Little more less, more kind of tree like.
Yeah. A little more piney, but it's like the zest of a citrus fruit, like it's zest of a grapefruit.
Oliver is going way ahead of us already. Yeah. He is your faithful companion in the woods, right?
Yes, he's a Scottish border collie. He knows where he's going. But we basically, everywhere we're walking, there's edible food all around us. Here we're standing next to a pile. We've got dandelions. Here's one of my absolute favorite greens. It's the leaves of an oxeye daisy. And another surprising green, because it has a sweetness to it. It almost tastes like green apple.
Mm-hmm.
And we use these in desserts and salads. All these greens are, they're quite strongly flavored. So it's nice to blend them and mix them together. So we put these in for a little herbal accent. We puree them and make sauces out of them. But we use them kind of like herbs as well as salad greens.
Because I see another one right there. I think I've got all over my garden.
Yeah. Yeah. That is called sheep sorrel. And the individual leaves are shaped like arugula or a rocket. Has a very lemony taste to it. And is very common. And I can see many different other things lying around here. There's dandelions. And right next to it, there's a rounded leaf version, which a lot of people mistake for a dandelion, but it's called a cat's ear. Hmm. And there's a delicate fuzz on it, but it's a similar profile. All the dandelions are quite bitter, but that, I mean, I'm holding a leaf now, which is about an inch long, and that's when they're at their peak of less bitterness, shall we say. They're still bitter. But all the bitter greens are really good for digestion.
And then something that I read this morning, actually, about the Oregon grape.
Yes.
Which is a common plant around here.
Yeah, right below our feet.
Now, so I know it because it produces some pretty tart berries in the fall, but you can actually harvest something from it ahead of, in the springtime.
Yeah, in a little, maybe about a month or so down the road, you'll have these little yellow flowers that pop up, and you can harvest the flowers and you can pickle them. And they have a kind of a caper-like quality. And even the green berries can be pickled or preserved, and they're very tart. But the real beauty of this plant is that in the fall, the berries, we make syrups out of them and jellies, lots of pectin, and super high in antioxidants, like almost off the charts. One of the highest antioxidant
properties of all the wild berries that we have here. These and Slal is pretty close to it, too.
Okay. We haven't got very far. No, and there's already all these things to look at.
Yeah, well, many of the plants that we harvest are considered weeds. And some are native to the Pacific Northwest, but many of them are introduced. Were introduced hundreds of years ago by settlers and pioneers and, you know, other avenues. A lot of them were called potage herbs. They came from, you know, the French background, like dandelions. And dandelion, very distinctive structure. It has sort of this downward tooth appearance on the leaves. And it comes from the Latin name for it. It was, I'll paraphrase it, but it was the French name was dent de lion. So lion's tooth, that right. Became dandelion. Okay, now we're standing on the Trans-Canada Trail. Which is an amazing jewel in our area. We walk it every day, the dog and myself. And lining this particular stretch, we've got big leaf maple trees. So the big leaf maples, the main product we get from them is big leaf maple syrup. That's usually in December to February. It's reduced down into an amazing syrup, lots of character, lots of spice to it. One of my favorite things from this area. But also in early spring, there's catkins, so the little flower pods. Those are okay, edible. People eat them. Saute with a bit of garlic is the way I prefer. But the new emerging buds are delicious. So right when the tree starts to just about to bloom into leaves, those little buds are excellent.
And that's, I know from some of the berry bushes that before, you know, if you don't want to wait until they actually have ripe berries on them, that the young shoots on berry bushes are good to eat as well.
Yeah, they are. They have quite a good vitamin C content. So in the First Nations world, for example, they were part of the first foods eaten in the spring. And they have... one of my favorite of those small buds is probably the Nootka Rose. So the Nootka Rose, right when the leaves start to unfurl, they have a really mild flavor and they taste like roses, so they're quite delicious. Okay, now we're standing over a small creek, and all along the sides you'll see beautiful yellow flowers. Those are skunk cabbage. When the yellow flower appears, there's a big stamen in the middle, which has lots of pollen, and that pollen is used sort of like almost like a flower. Lots of a good source of protein. The leaves were used more for carrying in baskets. I've heard some reports of eating them, but there are large crystals, oxalic crystals in them, which irritate your digestive system. So maybe if you were starving, you might eat them, but otherwise it might be not a good idea. And it has a very aromatic, shall we say, skunk-like fragrance.
That's one way of putting it, aromatic. one thing that you stressed in talking about harvesting these things is the idea of sustainability.
Yes, and some of that... we're talking about a huge range of plants and seaweed and ocean life. Sustainability comes in many forms. Some plants are very delicate, things like wild ginger. So that's something that can be damaged just by picking it. But there are many other plants that are, just because of the volume of them or the nature of the plant, harvesting them actually doesn't do too much damage. The bigger challenge to all this stuff is really more habitat destruction than the acts of foragers. The foragers are minute, even with mushroom picking, the act of foraging is a minute impact on the whole system. But clear cutting a forest is a gigantic component. You know, and things recover, and sometimes they come back with a little more diversity than when they were first cut down, but it takes 60 years for that process to replicate itself. The other thing I really stress is that there's lots of potential sources of contamination. So wild foods are not controlled. So you have little idea of if something has contaminated them. So we're standing around farmers' fields now, and one of the biggest sources of contamination is manure from E. coli. So I'm very, very cautious about picking greens that are in a field with animals.
Good advice. But as you say, there is some, you call it the low-hanging fruit, things that people can readily identify and are safe to eat and close by in most of our environments.
Yeah, I would start with berries. And in our area, one of the most prolific, and one thing that Cowichan is really known for is the blackberries. But all those blackberries that are harvested are coming from an invasive species called the Himalayan blackberry, which came from northern India. And it was brought here maybe 100 years ago and kind of took over. There's three different types of blackberries right where we are. The native blackberry is a trailing vine that runs along the ground. It's very tiny, very delicious, probably the nicest tasting berry. Next up would be the Himalayan blackberries, prolific, tend to fruit in huge, huge batches. So it's very easy to pick pounds of it in one small area. Very sweet, but very delicate berries. And then there's another berry, blackberry called the cutleaf blackberry, which was an introduced species that was used for blackberry farming, and now it's sort of gone wild and taken over, and in some cases competes with the Himalayan blackberry.
So you've been, you know, harvesting these things and using these things for years. But I hate using the word trend, but it certainly seems like people are paying a lot more attention to these kinds of forage foods now.
Yeah, I think so. And a lot of the credit probably goes to a restaurant in Copenhagen called Noma. And they were, for three years running, named the best restaurant in the world. And a lot of their stuff came from foraging, mixed in with the new Nordic sort of cuisine. But that was very influential, and now it's a pretty hot topic in places like LA, New York, Chicago, Vancouver, Toronto. So the chefs are sort of picking up on that foraged ethos, because the flavors are intense, and you can't really get a pure source of food. So here we're just walking a little farther down the trail. And we've come along a big patch of stinging nettles. And there seems to be a couple of different variants that occur here. These are the greener variety, and there's one that has sort of a reddish, purplish tinge to it. So I usually like to pick with gloves, but for you, I'm going to bear it all.
Oh my gosh.
You just pick off the upper stem. Usually there's a little bud of emerging flowers on top and a couple of big leaves. And these are in prime shape. You can see the little tiny hairs all along the stem, all along the edge of the leaf. And they contain folic acid, which stings, hence the name.
Are you getting a sting now, Riffle?
And when I pick a lot of them, my fingers will go numb on the ends and will last for like a day or so. But it's not unpleasant.
Uh-huh.
And the numbing is good, because once you started picking, you'll feel it afterwards, but it'll burn for a little bit. And these were used by local First Nations too, huge source of nutrients, and reputed to have lots of great qualities for digestion, for immune system building. Apparently good for people with arthritis and allergies as well. It's supposed to help sort of purge the system.
So I'm thinking for most people, you'd recommend that they wear gloves to
harvest.
Yeah,
wear gloves and a thicker glove. Because they'll penetrate even your pants if you're walking through a bunch of stinging nettles.
But once they're cooked or crushed up, the stinging disappears.
Right. Some people eat them raw, but I find the tingling to be quite distracting. So I blanch them for about 15 seconds in hot water, just to neutralize that acid, and then plunge them into cold water, so blanching them basically, putting them in cold water, stopping the cooking, stopping the decay process, so you can squeeze the water out, and they'll keep happily for about a week in the fridge once you've blanched them. Or you can take them and either put them in a Ziploc bag or vacuum pack them if you have the ability, and you can freeze it for several months. And then we use them after that as a vegetable, pureed into sauces, into soups. We make a stinging nettle pesto. We make a stinging nettle hummus with chickpeas. And it all provides this sort of beautiful, mild green color and flavor to whatever you put it into.
I actually had people up in near Courtney, the Legato Gelato people. They make a stinging nettle gelato. And I was really pleasantly surprised when I tasted it, because it was excellent. It had that nice tang to it in the aftertaste.
Yes. One thing I just did for the first time last week was I took a bunch of the nettles and I put it into a multigrain bread, and I made stinging nettle bread, and it was awesome.
Wow. The frogs are happy.
Yes. At nighttime, it is almost deafening. So it appears to be a very good year for frogs this year.
But we don't eat the frogs.
No. Although the bullfrogs are supposed to be eaten because they're
another
invasive species.
Hey, yeah.
In France, we ate quite a few of them, but I don't think it's really caught on that much here. But they were delicious. It tastes like chicken.
When it comes to the recipes in the cookbook, obviously you've included ingredients that are foraged in the wild, but if somebody doesn't have access to these, can they still pick up your cookbook and enjoy it?
Yeah, it's totally. For one, I try to keep the recipes as simple as possible. They don't require a huge shopping list. And secondly, I generally have substitutions for all of the flavor. Like if you don't have stinging nettles, you could take kale and make a pretty awesome substitute for any of the recipes. And mushrooms, for example, you can find a lot of the mushrooms readily dried. It's a little more difficult to find them fresh, but dried mushrooms will work, and also any kind of cultivated mushroom will work happily in all the recipes. And seaweed, luckily we're getting a lot of cultivated seaweed in our stores, so they all can be duplicated with processed or store-bought stuff. But having said that, the best stuff is wild. Okay, well, we're here in early spring, but we're in a bit of a marshy area just off the trail, and we're looking at a stand of cattails or bulrushes, and they are an amazing source of wild food. You can just see the new green shoots starting to come up out of the water now. There's a big rhizome root that looks like a big chunk of ginger that's in the bottom there, and some people eat the roots as well, but the new stalks come up, and you pluck them and they easily come off of this rhizome, and they look like a big giant leek, but the flavor can be described as kind of intensely cucumber. And we saute them as vegetables, we pickle them, they're an excellent pickle, put into salads, very, very interesting. And then on the top, the flower top, when it's really newly formed and green, they're eaten almost like corn on the cob, steamed, put a little butter, olive oil, some salt on it, chew on it. But that sort of is a window of opportunity when they're just really new, because afterwards they turn into like a big ball of cotton. So if you don't get them at the right time, a lot of people say it's horrible, but if they're just newly formed, they're quite delicious.
So what's your hope of what people will get out of this book? Not just cooking the recipes, but the actual reading of the book too.
Yeah, well, I think that one thing I discovered myself, and I think people discover when they come on the classes, is that you really have to be aware of your environment. There are lots of things that are poisonous, there's contaminants, so it kind of in some ways it forces you to think about the planet and what we're doing to it. So you have to try to seek out clean sources of this food, and in doing so you kind of by default, you know where the contamination is, and that's all around the people. So it's kind of forces you to be a little bit of an environmentalist from some point of view. So the more you can understand nature, the more you respect it, and I think only good can come from that.
Thanks for the walk today, Bill. Always a pleasure.
My pleasure. It's good to see you again.